but it wasn't by some grand decree. It's like trying to explain why nobody saw it. Once everyone started to see that the world was much smaller than ever before, and over there wasn't so far anymore. What we did unto others washed up on our shore. The answer was hard to ignore. The end of war. The end of war.
Good evening and welcome to Peace Talk. This is a production by the Juneau Chapter of Veterans for Peace for KTOO's radio Focus on Community. This is VFP's contribution to our community's ongoing conversation about war and peace and the important issues and questions they raise in our society and around the world. I'm Rich Moniak, your host tonight, and on this holiday commemorating the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we'll be hearing from the actors in The Mountaintop, which is playing now through February 1st at Perseverance Theater. The play is about the last hours of King's life. On April 3rd, 1968, Reverend King gave a speech titled, "I've Been to the Mountaintop," in support of the striking sanitation workers in Memphis. That night in his room at the Lorraine Hotel, he has an imagined conversation with the hotel maid about the success and disappointments in the civil rights movement and more. The play was written by playwright Katori Hall of Memphis, Tennessee, and was the winner of the 2010 Olivier Award for Best New Play. Michael Flood played Reverend King, and Liz Morgan played Kameh. Yeah, I get that right. That's an interesting thing when you watch the play. She'll have to correct Michael a couple of times on that. So, she was the mysterious hotel maid who came to bring coffee to Reverend King and wound up sharing Pall Malls, whiskey, and sometimes a serious, sometimes funny dialogue with him. Both actors are based in New York City and have dozens of performances to their credit. This is Michael's first time in the role of King. Liz performed as Kameh for the Capitol Repertory Theater in Albany, New York. Thank you both for joining me tonight.
Thank you for having us.
It's great to be here.
So this is your first time in Juneau.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you probably didn't expect to be spending January in Alaska with 40-degree temperatures and rain and little snow on the ground, or no snow on the ground?
Yeah, it's literally a warm welcome. Yeah, it's definitely colder back in New York.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised by the weather here. I was told by a lot of people, mostly people who aren't from Alaska, that I was going to encounter some blizzards and igloos and polar bears, but haven't seen any of that. A little bit disappointed, but...
you've been to the glacier. You've seen the
big
ice.
I have been to the glacier, yeah. That was beautiful.
And the rain's rather fitting for the opening act when you come to the door with your... You don't have your newspaper tonight. It's pouring.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm staying dry.
So I've seen the play twice. Thoroughly enjoyed it both times. I think you were both sensational.
Thank you.
In fact, I think the second time, it was more fun because I was anticipating scenes I remembered that I liked and I could really get into them. So, but let me start by asking, have you worked together before?
No. Mm-mm.
This is your first time.
We met for the first time in New York right before leaving, just to look each other in the eye and say, see you in Juneau.
Yeah, I think I sent an email to Shona at Perseverance, just inquiring who the role of Kameh is going to be played by. And I looked up Liz Morgan, and I was like, okay, let me try to contact her, friended her on Facebook, all the intel stuff. And, yeah, we got to meet for coffee and stuff, and... got a feel for,
what the task at hand was.
Exactly.
Yeah. So let me ask. Start by asking you, Michael, how did you feel preparing for a role as an acting in, as Reverend King? I mean, it's. Do you have anything different that you did in this role because of the nature of the man you were playing?
There's a number of different things that it gave me an entirely different experience from other roles I've played before. First off, this is probably the largest role. It's the first role I've ever played where I'm on stage with one other actor for an hour and a half carrying the story, and it's just the two of us having to keep this ball up in the air, keep the momentum up without dropping a ball, without dropping the moments, without dropping the dramatic tension. And I think what was most difficult, well, first I was excited about the role. No, because who wouldn't want to play Dr. Martin Luther King? And and I got the script at the local drama bookstore in New York City, and then I started highlighting my role, and I was like, wait a minute. There's so much yellow highlighting in it, like the whole book was just like very wet and very like just bright yellow. And I was like, yeah, I have a task ahead of me. And I just had to commit and be as detailed as possible in the role, do as much research as I could. And it's interesting because there's a point where you have to stop researching and you have to start really trusting the text that's given to you by the playwright. There's the real world of King, and then there's the imagined world from the perspective of the playwright. And as an actor, you really have to honor that at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Well, and today at St. Paul's Catholic Church for the Martin Luther King Day celebration, you did an excerpt from the speech that tells me that you did a lot of listening to his speeches because you really nailed that.
Oh, thank you. With the help from the director, I really just listened to his rhythm, listened to where he puts emphasis on certain phrases and his style of speaking and where he uses his voice and his body and really have to physicalize it. It's a fine line between embodying the role of King and then doing the imitation of him. So I really had to put my own uniqueness into his style of speaking. It had to be like a blend of the two of us when performing this role in the play.
So, and Liz, you had a scene in the play where you've got to sort of imitate King as well. Is that the first time you've ever done anything like that?
Maybe not so much. Sort of like a blend of two things that happened a lot in grade school for me. I grew up in a predominantly white neighborhood in suburban Connecticut, and one of the sort of MLK Day traditions that I would do all the way, I think, up until high school, there was like one black teacher at the elementary school who would always ask me to do some type of like excerpt, Martin Luther King Day reading, sort of thing. I was never doing an impersonation then, but just like my theater training, I've done various impersonations in my life. So sort of blending the skills I learned as a performer of how to do an impersonation with this experience I've had sort of doing MLK for more educational purposes kind of came together in a fun way. But I guess I try not to make Kameh a trained actress in that moment. So a funny thing that I kind of do, I think I might have told you this, Mike, is a cartoon I like that has a really funny scene where MLK kind of comes back to life and talks to the modern youth about what's going on. And so I actually do more of an imitation of that cartoon imitating King just to make it a little bit more theatrical, because I think if she could do a spot on King, that might be a little weird, but it's one of my favorite moments in the play.
Yeah, it was definitely one of mine. Yeah, definitely. And there was I mentioned that the event at St. Paul's today, and at the end of that, our local pastor, Phil Campbell from the Northern Light United Church here in town, gave a excerpt from a different speech from King, and I thought he did a remarkably lively job, and as well, captured all of King's energy and really sent us away understanding and remembering what King stood for. I mean, did you get that same feeling? Were you surprised after listening to him?
He did a pretty good job, yeah. I did. He's very passionate about it and it's very engaging. Yeah. He definitely knew what he was doing.
I think those two speeches, those pieces at the end was the highlight of that day for me today. Mm-hmm. Yeah, listening to him, I was 12 years old when King was killed. I don't remember much about him until that day. Occasionally heard the news and probably didn't pay much attention to it as a 12-year-old kid growing up in Massachusetts and paid more attention to baseball and the Beatles, which is one of the names that comes up mm-hmm. last night at the point of his play last night, but. You know, over the years, I've learned a lot more. And since we went to you know, war in this century even more. You know, what was it like for you? I'm sure neither one of you were around during King's life. You know, and the typical Martin Luther King Day celebration that focuses on civil rights, those are great accomplishments. They're important accomplishments. But he stood for a lot more things. And what did you, while you were researching and learning for these roles, did you learn new things about King that surprised you in his life and his work?
So many answers. I think one aspect of King that really stood out to me was the self-empowerment, the black empowerment King, the one who later in his career, he was really stressing the black community developing a strong economic base to develop resources for each other and distribute those resources amongst each other so they can basically have the power to sway votes, have the power to pick certain politicians in office who will, you know, have a vested interest in their needs. I really admired that aspect of King later on in his life, and it's quite unfortunate that he didn't really get to live to see that dream.
Yeah, he has a piece in his speech on the mountaintop, at the speech in Memphis, mm-hmm. that he very directly talked to that issue. And that's part of the issues, I guess, that was perceived to be threatening the status quo, to take away business from the white sector.
Which is quite interesting because fundamentally, it wasn't much different from what Marcus Garvey was preaching and what Malcolm X was saying and also what the Nation of Islam was promoting as well. They were all people who found ways to develop businesses where they could build capital and then get the resources to share amongst each other. And
what about you, Liz? Any insights from studying his work for this play? Any new ideas of what he's about?
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite things about the play is the way Katori Hall sort of laces the script with fun facts about MLK's personal life. Seems like a big part of you know, what the play is about. It's about the man, not the legend. Mm-hmm. And you know, we've talked about just why this play. And so I think for me, some of the most striking facts to learn have to do with the fact that he wasn't the demigod that I think we sometimes think of him as. He achieved great things, but this was a man with weaknesses, with flaws, that was suffering from depression, that had heart conditions, and all sorts of things that I think a lot of us let stop us from achieving our greatness, be it illness, relationship issues, feeling like you're the only person in the world that gets what you're talking about. I mean, the play discusses that his own men, his best friend even, that they weren't fully supportive of these other interests he had outside of the main focus of civil rights.
Well, he did lose support from a lot of different mm-hmm. sectors once he started speaking out against Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he was, I believe when he began the advocating more to eradicate poverty and to help the poor, people were viewing that as it's too big for him to handle.
Yeah.
And
that he kept doing that as best he could. And I mean, he still came up against, you know, his own limitations. I was talking to my mother earlier about Bayard Rustin's role in the movement.
Right.
And how, you know, black LGBTQ struggles, he felt the need to sort of put that to a side, to focus on something else. And so that this man that was juggling so many things, both personally and ideologically,
mm-hmm.
You know, that he still persevered.
Definitely. I mean, because I think King Amon's, most people know that, you know, the black community is not a monolith. It's so nuanced. It's so complex. There's so many different voices that need to be heard. And it's just, it is a struggle for one man to try to balance all that and try to put that on the forefront. It's almost impossible, and that's why some things get into a spotlight over others.
Well, the spotlight and the highlight for me, and what I would like to do now is play an excerpt from his mountaintop speech that focused on his dedication to nonviolence, because I think that was his intent with the expanding his work towards opposing Vietnam and towards working for the sanitation workers, working for the poor and the disenfranchised in a different way, was to keep working in a nonviolent manner. So let's listen to a short excerpt from his speech in Memphis on the on April 3rd, 1968.
We are masters in our nonviolent movement in disarming police forces. They don't know what to do. I've seen them so often. I remember in Birmingham, Alabama, when we were in that majestic struggle there. We would move out of the 15th Street Baptist Church day after day. By the hundreds, we would move out, and Bull Connor would tell them to send the dogs for us. And they did come. But we just went before the dogs singing, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around." Bull Connor next would say, "Turn the fire hoses on." And as I said to you the other night, Bull Connor didn't know history. He knew a kind of physics that somehow didn't relate to the transphysics that we knew about. And that was the fact that there was a certain kind of fire that no water could put out. And we went before the fire hose. We had known water. If we were Baptists or some other denominations, we had been immersed. If we were Methodists and some others, we had been sprinkled, but we knew water. That couldn't stop us. And we just went on before the dogs, and we would look at them, and we'd go on before the water hoses, and we would look at it. And we just go on singing, "Over my head, I see freedom in the air." And then we would be thrown into paddy wagons, and sometimes we were stacked in there like sardines in a can. They would throw us in, and old Bull would say, "Take them out." They did, and we would just go on in the paddy wagon singing, "We shall overcome." And every now and then we'd get in jail, and we'd see the jailer looking through the windows, being moved by our prayer and being moved by our words and our songs. And there was a power there which Bull Connor couldn't adjust to. And so we ended up transforming Bull into a seer, and we won our struggle in Birmingham. We've got to go on in Memphis just like that. I call upon you to be with us when we go out Monday.
So that was Reverend King speaking in Memphis the day before the play, the day of the play, mm-hmm. the day of the night he goes into his hotel. And of course, he's speaking about nonviolence there, and Kamei's not happy with that. She thinks that's not going to work. She has some fun with that. You want to talk about that a little bit, Liz?
I think a little bit. Yeah, I think very unfortunately that struggle, that tension between nonviolence and radicalism in the Black freedom movement is very present in 2015. And there's there's a sense of helplessness, I think, that comes up in the play, of not knowing what to do in the face of a lost humanity. And I guess as you already mentioned in your intro, I have played this role twice. And the first time was a little bit after the Trayvon Martin case. But something very different is happening this go-round that very much affected my presence to that frustration in my re-portrayal, I guess I'll call it, of Kameh. And so Lydia talked about this a little bit on a different program. I think she was on Juno Afternoons.
Mm-hmm.
That when we touched down in Juno, they were doing the Black Lives Matter rally here. And so it felt very important to be getting this message out, and having the dialogue in front of an audience right now.
Mm-hmm.
Of, you know, we're not just walking, we're marching, one of King's lines in the play. Mm-hmm. Coming up against Kameh's whatever it is, it ain't working.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are protests going on across this nation, with young people who are more than a generation removed from the events that we're talking about, this struggle. So I think there's just less knowledge about how do we do it.
Mm-hmm.
Right, if it was being done right then.
But a lot of young people are stepping forward right now. There are a lot of movements, especially in Ferguson, where they don't know what to do, but they need to do something. And what I love about social media now is that they're using it in a positive way to, you know, inform other people what's going on at the present moment in Ferguson, going beyond the news waves, really trying to get the truth out there.
Yeah. I mean, it's a weird tension because I think there's a distrust of news as media.
Mm-hmm.
But it also holds a power that I think if it doesn't get infiltrated right now, the social media movement sort of lacks the full power it could have. I was talking with one of our friends earlier on over lunch just about the nonviolence training that she received around the Vietnam War. And that in New York, I haven't heard that much about that. There are, you know, hashtags and Facebook events of people knowing where the protests are happening. But I don't know that, you know, these my fellow freedom fighters know exactly what it means to be in the midst of protest, you know, how to protect yourself, you know, if you get thrown in jail and all of those things. So it's a different time where I just think there's an organization that's lacking in what's coming together. And sometimes you have to just move. But I look forward to going back to New York and, you know, talking with community leaders about what can be done to train people for nonviolent protests and really prepare.
It's interesting because it seems to be a rift between the older generation of the civil who were a part of the civil rights movement and this new generation of, you know, very, you know, strong-willed young people who want to make a change. I feel like maybe the older generation feels the younger generation are doing it wrong,
or for the wrong reasons.
Or for the wrong reasons. And yeah, I don't know how, but there has to be some way where we can link up and the older generation can be mentors to young people and allow them to, like in the show, carry on the baton.
Yeah.
And let the young people be the leaders.
Yeah, and I think that there's two things. There's one thing that's missing, it seems like, in this era, in this generation, or two generations later, is a leader like King was, somebody that people could come around and follow with the one strong message of nonviolence. I think the leadership is smaller and more fragmented.
For sure.
there is definitely a generational thing. I think possibly the generation in the 60s had more at stake than perceived today. And I don't think that's just necessarily true in the civil rights movement. I think that's true in a lot of middle-class America.
That's interesting, because I feel like there's a lot of things at stake right now. Like young black men are dying every 28 hours, I believe, by police brutality or some form of it. And then there's a huge population of minorities in the prison industrial complex used as, it's another form of slavery. They are building chairs for schools and office buildings. They are building products for other companies. It's just, I feel like there are issues that need to be fought for right now.
There definitely are, and I guess I was getting at maybe is what was more at stake back then is I think it affected everybody.
Mm.
Black Americans were much more under the weight of the Jim Crow laws, the white oppression, the white leadership. I mean, nobody was paying attention. There's been a lot of progress made. And I completely agree that there are problems today, but it's if you're not in that, you know, for instance, the young man that spoke at the church today grew up in Juneau,
mm-hmm.
you know, and would have no personal connection to the civil rights need, the oppression that was going on in the 60s. So, yeah, I agree there definitely are things that need to be worked on, and we feel the same generational disconnect sort of when it comes to the war and peace movements, mm-hmm. you know, or the anti-war and peace movements. I mean, during this war, this era is quite, it's an older generation. There aren't young people out there, and we need, you know, young leaders to emerge from the ranks of whether it's from the soldiers that have been there and are mm-hmm. now opposing the wars or somewhere, somebody needs to step up and mobilize or bring those people together. I think it's something needs to be done on all fronts.
Definitely.
Which the play speaks very powerfully too. There's a lot more work to do,
mm-hmm.
you know? So I want to take a little station break at this point. I want to remind listeners, you're listening to KTOO in Juneau. This is Peace Talk, Veterans for Peace production. I have the actors from the Mountaintop play at Perseverance on, Michael Flood and Liz Morgan with me, and we're going to listen to a song that was written by U2 in 1984 that was dedicated to Martin Luther King. It was the title of it is Pride in the Name of Love.
Yeah.
Well, welcome back to Peace Talk. I'm Rich Moniak. I got Michael Flood and Liz Morgan with me, and we've been talking during the break a little bit about the disconnect between generations and the uninvolvement of today's a lot of segments of society today, and it seems real. There is a lot of work to do. How do we mobilize people? I mean, this play powerfully calls to that. Do you think people will even pick that message up and do anything with it?
Oh, gosh. I hope so. I mean, that's why we do what we do. And I think, like, every field, every discipline, I think, hopefully has a component where empathy is a part of it. I mean, I think people could feel like it's a daunting message that the play ends with. But I don't necessarily know that the message is to, like, find the king inside of you.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the end talks about, maybe a little bit of a spoiler here, the play has a moment that sort of looks into the future. And it talks about all sorts of people, not just civil rights leaders, but artists, musicians, a lot of accomplishments and disappointments that have brought us to where we are and will continue to move us forward. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, for us, maybe increasing empathy through theater is part of what we do. But, you know, school teachers do that in their own way. Doctors do that in their own way. People that are in customer service do that in their own way. So how do you, you know, in your own sort of microcosm of the world, promote peace, promote tolerance, and sort of look at people without prejudice, I think makes just as much of a difference. There's definitely like tiny moments of heroism that are possible, I think. I hope that the play inspires that and lets us all know that, yeah, even if you're struggling with heart problems and relationship problems and it's raining, you can still be an incredible person, make an incredible difference. Because the Camus feels very small in front of Dr. King and doesn't think that she'll have any contribution to his life. But even in those last hours, she does find a way to make a small difference, and that's her little mini miracle. So I think that's part of what The Mountaintop's about.
Mm-hmm. I feel like for King in this play, it's not only how to stay relevant, but how to reach out to people of different genders, different economic backgrounds, how to get that person to believe in his dream. And I feel like as King in this play, I'm fighting hard for Camus to believe in me and to see that my dream is not in vain and it's not something that's outdated.
Well, King definitely called to all of us to what Phil Campbell said today, to be great means to serve.
Mm-hmm.
And the next excerpt I want to play from his speech is one of those calls to everybody. It's a reminder. He's reading something as a minister would do from the Bible and interpreting a parable. And it's the end is really where we're all at. So let's take another. This is a little longer excerpt, but it's worth listening to. It's Dr. Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm. Now let me say, as I move to my conclusion, that we've got to give ourselves to this struggle until the end. Nothing would be more tragic than to stop at this point in limits. We got to see it through. When we have our march, you need to be there. If it means leaving work, if it means leaving school, be there. Yeah. and concerned about your brother. You may not be on strike, but either we go up together or we go down together. Let us develop a kind of dangerous unselfishness. One day a man came to Jesus. He wanted to raise some questions about some vital matters of life. Point, he wanted to trick Jesus and show him that he knew a little more than Jesus knew and throw him off base. Now that question could have easily ended up in a philosophical and theological debate. But Jesus immediately pulled that question from midair and placed it on the dangerous curve between Jerusalem and Jericho. He talked about a certain man who fell among thieves. You remember that a Levite, the priest passed by on the other side, they didn't stop to help him. Finally, a man of another race came by. He got down from his beast, decided not to be compassionate by proxy. But he got down with him, administered first aid, and helped the man in need. Jesus ended up saying this was the good man, this was the great man. Because he had the capacity to project the eye into the thou and to be concerned about his brother. Now you know we use our imagination a great deal to try to determine why the priest and the Levite didn't stop. At times we say they were busy going to a church meeting, an ecclesiastical gathering, and they had to get on down to Jerusalem so they wouldn't be late for their meeting. At other times, we would speculate that there was a religious law that one who was engaged in religious ceremonials was not to touch a human body 24 hours before the ceremony. And every now and then we begin to wonder whether maybe they were not going down to Jerusalem, or down to Jericho rather, to organize a Jericho Road Improvement Association. That's a possibility. Maybe they felt that it was better to deal with the problem from the causal root rather than to get bogged down with an individual effect. But I'm going to tell you what my imagination tells me. It's possible that those men were afraid. You see, the Jericho Road is a dangerous road. I remember when Mrs. King and I were first in Jerusalem. We rented a car and drove from Jerusalem down to Jericho. And as soon as we got on that road, I said to my wife, I can see why Jesus used this as the setting for his parable. It's a winding, meandering road. It's really conducive for ambushing. You start out in Jerusalem, which is about 1,200 miles, or rather 1,200 feet above sea level. And by the time you get down to Jericho, 15 or 20 minutes later, you're about 2,200 feet below sea level. That's a dangerous road. In the days of Jesus, it came to be known as the Bloody Path. You know it's possible that the priest and the Levite looked over that man on the ground and wondered if the robbers were still around. Or it's possible that they felt that the man on the ground was merely taken. And he was acting like he had been robbed and hurt in order to seize them over there, lure them there for quick and easy seizure. And so the first question that the priest asked, the first question that the Levite asked was, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came by, and he reversed the question. If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? That's the question before you tonight. Not if I stop to help the sanitation worker, what will happen to my job? Not if I stop to help the sanitation worker, what will happen to all of the hours that I usually spend in my office every day and every week as a pastor? The question is not if I stop to help this man in need, what will happen to me? The question is, if I do not stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to them? That's the question. Let us rise up tonight with a greater readiness. Let us stand with a greater determination. Let us move on in these powerful days, these days of challenge, to make America what it ought to be. We have an opportunity to make America a better nation. And I want to thank God once more for allowing me to be here with you.
So that's what King is calling on us all to look out for somebody else. And you know, when he's down there in Memphis with all his the big things he had done already in the past several years to take time out for sanitation workers on strike is his example of looking out for somebody else, stepping down, you know, making himself available to the more common folk again. You know, there's a part in the play where I think you say, why me?
Mm-hmm.
And Kameh says, why not? You know, and there's also something, I'm not sure if it's in the play or not, but just the idea that one man do it alone? You know, I think that's a paradoxical element of his life, that here he is trying to lead everybody, but he's also asking everybody because he knows he can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. You know, there's certainly something biblical about that part of his life. And it's so funny because we love these sci-fi movies about the one.
Mm-hmm.
We love The Matrix and watching Neo, but he has a team, and we love watching The Hunger Games and Katniss becomes the one, but she also has a team. But then there's just a way when it's real life, we kind of keep expecting that hero to rise, not realizing that in these stories, those are all average people that find themselves called into greatness with the support of people around them, and it's not convenient, you know, as King is just saying in that last excerpt, it is absolutely not convenient, but it is so very necessary to just take the time to do the right thing. I mean, I want to give a quick shout out. There's another show going on still right now, Generator Theater Company, is doing a show about homelessness in Juneau called A Lifetime to Master. Mike and I saw it. I guess it was the preview, but it was still great then, and I'm sure it's only
very,
gotten,
very powerful content. Just the stories alone to hear about the homeless population in Juneau.
And yeah, we were, you know, we're here. We're from New York, so it'd be really easy to like walk away and say, well, homelessness in Juneau doesn't really have anything to do with us. But it does, and I think that's the power of the theater, that we walked away, you know, starting to talk about, well, what can we do, even if it's with our short time here? And I don't know that we have an answer yet, but, like, now that's part of the discussions we're having.
Yeah, not to veer too much off topic, but with that play, which I really connected with, was that I felt any one of us could be in that situation as the homeless if we just make one wrong move or a circumstance out of our control gets the best of us and we end up on the streets. I mean, any of us can be those people. Some of us are one paycheck away from that. And to hear these stories and to not feel obligated to do something, or at least to feel that it could happen to you sometime, is I would be surprised.
Well, and the playwright, I think her name's Mary Ellison.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. I listened to her last Monday night. She did a little presentation to the city assembly promoting the play, talking about where she got started. And her story fits this you know, this last message from King really very well, because she said she just happened to run into somebody who was homeless, who she had never seen before, and she couldn't turn her back. She couldn't walk away from it. You know, it was something that caused her to act where she could have just done what most people do and you know, look away, get back to their regular life, like you're saying, you know, go back to avoid the inconvenience.
Yeah, I mean, that's that good Samaritan story. So that's, I mean, this is like one of those really relevant biblical stories that I find, you know, there's so much to that. And so when I think about, some of these protests, and yes, they are shutting down Grand Central, and yes, you may be late home for work, but, you know, can those protests, in their stopping people, really change thought? And I hope that's what's starting to happen. I really do.
Well, and I think the expectation that it will do anything immediately is a dangerous place to be, too, because when you don't, when your dream's not realized, if it has to be and it's not, you tend to become very apathetic and give up. You can walk away too easy.
Yeah.
And, well, a lot of people seem to forget is that the Montgomery bus boycott, because over 300 days, this was after planning, after many, many days and months and years of planning, it took over 300 days for it once it was put into action. And I think that's somewhat the young people have to keep in mind, too, that you got to be in this for the long haul if you want to see, feasible change.
And you may not see it, but you may plant seeds that your children will see.
Yeah.
Which is what you're seeing from King's work as his children, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people have been posting quotes today. I mean, there's you can't learn enough about King and his family and his legacy. There was a great one from Coretta Scott King. I'm probably going to misquote it, but everyone should go to Google and look up the real thing. But, you know, she basically talked about how the freedom struggle is every generation. It doesn't end. Like, you know, I don't know. Hopefully our generation isn't thinking like, well, we're going to solve it.
No, the next generation is like, remember when we weren't free?
Yeah, now we all are.
So, can you believe that happened?
You know,
the struggle changes form.
Yeah, that King's message is keeping our eyes on the prize. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that he says it, but he didn't have an end in sight, but that keeping that possibility every day open for what would it be if this world was more free, and waking up with that in your heart, I think is just so powerful. And if that can motivate your interactions, we'll be moving in the right direction.
What I definitely enjoy about this play is that as the actor playing King, is that in the beginning I feel like King doesn't really believe that there's other people who can do his job. Like, I'm the only one alone that can do this, and people just have to listen to how I do it and they just have to follow. But I mean, without spoiling anything, my character, he faces life and death. And after coming, have to answer to that, then you have to make a decision where, what do I do? Do I stop the movement, or do I have to put faith that the people, you know, the younger generation will take it over, or if my own men would take over? That's...
Well, there's an element to the play that I thought, I had somebody comment to me last night that Camé stole the show, that her role was more powerful or you know, more, she had some of the better parts, and she was obviously a surprise, which plays into a, you know, you notice more surprises than what you expect. And but I think it, part of that to me seemed that her role had to do that, to have this element of bringing King down to a common human being, to take him off the pedestal of the greatness that he was, both for what you're saying, that he did need help, as well as he is just a man.
Mm-hmm.
And as a man, that call to each of us is more powerful because we all have something in us potentially that could rise up to a higher level, as he did.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, I mean, the way this show is set up, it's kind of funny because it's a show about someone that we know, well, I'm not going to say everything about, someone that maybe we think we know everything about, Dr. Mm-hmm. King, and then this woman
mm-hmm.
that if you're marketing the show well, you don't say too much about. So then I think people maybe come in thinking, well, maybe this is more of like a one-man show with a woman that has like a bit part to help him, you know, get a sip of water if the actor's throat gets dry. Like, they have no idea what Kameh is. She has a weird name, all of that stuff. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess Kameh has the element of surprise. I get that in my benefit, to my benefit when I walk on stage. You know, I don't have to go on stage having people have all of their perceptions about who I am shake me up every night. that's what Mike has to go to bed with. But yeah, no, I get to go on stage and know that yeah, they can only be surprised. I can't let them down.
Yeah.
So that's really freeing and it's really fun. But I definitely think the play is about them meeting as equals, and seeing, yeah, a great man come down to earth and seeing a very earthly person have sort of miraculous effect on this man that I think surprises her.
It's almost like, I feel like King goes through like a regenerative process, some kind of reincarnation. Like, he is this man of greatness, a great leader of his community, of the civil rights movement, but then he's taken down to a man, but then he becomes, well, without spoiling anything, he becomes an inspiration for others. He kind of, his spirit, his power, his will spreads among the people and inspires others to want to make change.
Well, we're getting close,
legacy,
close to the end of the show. I've got the very end of his mountaintop speech to play. That's about 2 minutes, and then we'll have a little bit more discussion and call it an evening.
All right, sounds good.
It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, we are sorry for the delay. But we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane. And to be sure that all of the bags were checked. And to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully. And we've had the plane protected and guarded all night. And then I got into Memphis. And some began to say the threat, or talk about the threat that were out. What would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers? Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now. Because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about it.
And that was the end of King's speech in Memphis the night before he was assassinated. And that last part, Michael did a wonderful presentation of that speech today at St. Paul's Church. And we're pretty close to running out of time, and I'm going to want to thank you both for being here. It's been a wonderful conversation. And I highly recommend everybody that's listening tonight to take in this play. It's a remarkable piece of work. Two wonderful actors put their heart into it, and I don't know what else I can say, but it's really worth seeing. It's really worth hearing the message that's there and taking a deeper look into Martin Luther King's life than we usually do through this imaginative evening that he has before he's assassinated. Anyway, you've been listening to KTOO in Juneau. This is Peace Talk, and that's our program for tonight. Thank you.
The end of war, 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 the end of war.
You're tuned in to KTOO News in Juneau. The following program is underwritten in part by Organic Valley Family of Farms, celebrating 20 years organic and farmer-owned since 1988. Meet your local farmers at organicvalley.coop.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature.